Now, International Women's Day, March 8th, 1981, continues with a talk given by journalist Ann Nelson yesterday at a meeting convened by the International Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. This is part of what's going to be a two-part program on women in Latin America. Part one will be broadcast tonight and will be a journalist's view of women and the situation in El Salvador. Part two will present the views of some of the women who are actually involved in these struggles in Latin America. So what you're going to be hearing now is journalist Ann Nelson giving a journalist's view of the situation in El Salvador today and the role of women.
My experience and interest in El Salvador started well over a year ago. In fact, 2 years ago, I was talking to a young woman with the State Department who said, well, everything's going on in Nicaragua now, but watch for El Salvador, it's going to be next. And I kind of kept that in mind, and a year ago last December, I started writing an article about the new junta, which was only 3 months old at that time. And I was working out of Washington. I was credentialed in the State Department press gallery, and everything that was coming out of the State Department said that things were just rosy, that the land reform was being announced and everything was being set up, and I was clipping my little articles and writing about this. And then I started talking to some of the Salvadorans in the Latin neighborhood, Mount Pleasant, Adams Morgan in Washington, and they said, don't believe it. There are people being massacred in the countryside. This was December and January of last year. And some of them were church people. Some of them were church people out of this building from the World Council of Churches. The news was coming out, and yet as far as Washington was concerned, that news didn't exist. And I was in Washington writing my story and going half crazy, saying, what do I write? I don't know. I don't know. And I finally went with the friends. I went with the church people against the State Department, feeling that I might be discredited as a journalist for the rest of my life as a result. And I found that I had to go and see for myself. I went to Nicaragua for a month in April, and then I went to El Salvador for a month in May, late April and May. I would like to talk a little bit about El Salvador through the subject of women, and maybe tell a couple of stories of the women that I met, living and dead, who have remained very much in my mind and very much a part of my life as a result. After I'd been in El Salvador a couple of weeks, I was staying in a house rented by a group of international journalists near the U.S. Embassy. I came home one day, and there was firing in the street. There were armored cars down the block, and there were something like 50 National Guardsmen and policemen well within view. They had mortars, they had submachine guns, they had a tank, and they were assaulting a private house. Now, the strange thing was that they had all of this military barrage against this house, and the only fire you could hear from inside the house was a little pistol shot, okay? And you had this veritable army ranged outside. You had plainclothesmen with submachine guns, you know, kind of like a strike force and so on. And finally, the little pistol shots, the 22 pistol shots, ceased. Everything was very quiet. And my fellow journalists had told me that this had been going on for an hour before I got there. The smoke started clearing, and the first group of policemen and journalists went inside. There was a young man of about 25 who was lying dead in the bathroom. There was a woman, I would say perhaps 40 or 45. She was wearing an apron and a kerchief. She was lying dead in a pool of blood. She had apparently been killed by a grenade. There was a young girl of maybe 17 or 18, also dead in a pool of blood. There was a mimeograph machine. This was a propaganda house for the FPL, which is one of the organizations, and it had a lot of literature printed up for the bloque. There were notes. There were documents. There were notes that said, we must educate the people, we must reach the people. And all of this was kind of thrown around in a great bit of excitement to show the journalists that what this was. And then, this was the moment when I couldn't believe my eyes, okay? I was the only woman in the group. I was also the only journalist from the United States. In fact, I was the only journalist from the United States who was in El Salvador for more than 2 or 3 days over that entire month, okay? At that point, the head of the Policía Nacional went to another room and he picked up a submachine gun. And he went over and he knelt beside the 45-year-old woman and he put it in her hand. And he said, this was the arm. This was the gun she was using to fire against us. And he took a box of clean bullets. They were still wrapped up in different colored papers and everything. And he dumped them on the floor in her blood and said, this was her ammunition. Okay? Now, the international press and the Salvadoran press and me and I were there, and they were all taking pictures and saying, right, right, and taking notes. You know, had submachine gun firing on government forces. Terrorist, guerrilla, right? And there was this rather kindly-looking middle-aged woman, and then he repeated the process with a 17-year-old girl. She got an Uzi or something, I don't know. And she also got the bullets poured around in her own blood. And up on the wall, someone, and I will never know who, whether it was them or whether it was the government security forces who were with plainclothesmen at the time, who might have been described in some press reports as right-wing terrorist death squads, all right? Someone had written the letters in their blood, FPL, on the wall. And in fact, I did take pictures of this. I took pictures of the man dumping the bullets, and I took pictures of him putting the gun in their hands. And I came back and I talked to some magazines and newspapers about it, and they said it wasn't news. That was a corollary of that experience for me, because when I came back in June, I also had taped testimonies with some of the refugees from the Rio Sumpul massacre. And I had written testimonies from Honduran clergymen that had witnessed the killing of 600 peasants on the border. And that wasn't news either. That wasn't news. I went to major newspapers. I talked to foreign editors. And they were very sorry, but there was no interest in it. So sometimes I feel as though El Salvador has been created over the past 2 months in an abstract fashion by people who have never been there, by people who have never talked to a Salvadoran. All of a sudden, it's become a geopolitical concern. And we see documents captured from guerrilla terrorist houses that are being presented as proof of all sorts of things. None of them, by the way, having anything to do with the lives and the destinies of the people of El Salvador. I think women are a part of the movement in El Salvador, partly because they're very strong, very remarkable women, partly because they have no choice whatsoever. They're not given any favors. They're not treated like ladies. There is a pampered class of the wives of coffee plantations who have all of their maids and are treated with the greatest and most gentlemanly caballero consideration. But below that class, there aren't any breaks for the women of El Salvador. And if they are suspected of political activity, I think the torture, and I think the punishment takes on a special vengeance. I think there's a special sexual hatred that happens, because when I've heard the stories of the relatives and the compañeros of women who have been captured by the guard, they're even more vicious with them than they are with the men. I think I can say that, and I wouldn't lightly. I won't go into too much of that, but I think also very much of the woman whose body I saw, whose face had been cut and peeled off her skull. She was 16 years old, couldn't have been much older. Who knows what her involvement was? She may have never touched a gun. She may never have gone to a political meeting. But she was regarded as part of the enemy. And when they talk about the enemy there, and I'm talking about the government and the right-wing paramilitary forces that work hand in glove with the government, I'm talking also about the landowners that have seen El Salvador as their fiefdom. They're like medieval lords. They see them not only subhuman, they see them as sub-animals. They give them treatment that they would not give a horse or a dog. And the women not only catch this directly, but since they are the center of the families, they watch this happening to their parents, to their husbands, to their lovers, to their children. And if you want to understand the situation in El Salvador, I think you have to include the experience of the women. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen to figure into the geopolitical abstractions that we are presented with on the front pages of our newspapers. I was also asked to speak a little bit to what is going on right now, and to go back to a reporter's standpoint. I had a very interesting talk with a newspaper editor a few days ago who told me that many women were not qualified to report on wartime situations because they couldn't look at reality. They kept getting upset about dead people. And I took that a little personally, actually. I said, yes, I do feel that the dead people figure into the situation. I think that also matters when you're writing about a war. One interesting aspect is that the State Department and the Salvadoran government have never said that there were more than 5,000 guerrillas in the entire country of El Salvador. That 5,000 is the bottom line as far as the guerrillas. Now, you compare that with the figures that the Catholic Church and the Human Rights Office have given out, that more than 12,000 people were killed in the country last year. So, you put those numbers together, and whatever you feel about the movement for liberation in El Salvador, you also see that fighting simply the guerrilla is not the main thrust of government policy. Those are not the people that they're even aiming at. There's been a lot of news this week. There's been the threat of a right-wing coup, which means that we have to build up our support for the moderate government and so on. It's a very Byzantine set of political circumstances, and one has to almost immerse oneself in studying ins and outs and names and alphabet soup for a few months before making much sense of it. In October, a year ago from last October, three groups of military men presented themselves to the U.S. Embassy. One, led by Colonel Mahano, had some reforms in mind, and they were, within the military, regarded as a liberal wing. Another group had long-standing and very warm ties with the United States through the CIA, through the agrarian reform programs that were intended to buy off a lot of the movements within El Salvador. A third group was what I call the ultra-right-wing Nazi element in El Salvador, who said that no reforms or no appearance of reform was necessary in El Salvador. What was necessary was to kill 100,000 people, because that was about the number of troublemakers. And they had done it before in 1932. When there were troublemakers, they killed everyone that appeared to be associated with them, and if that was 30,000 people, that was fine, because these sub-animals were very good at breeding, and they always produced more. And that was their ideology. So now, since the population has increased, we might have to kill 100,000, we might have to kill 200,000, but that bullets will solve every problem. As the United States did not go with any one of these three groups, it kind of forced a marriage between them. And there were representatives of each of these three groups in that first junta. There were also Christian Democrats and Social Democrats who put a good public relations face on things for Europe, for other Latin American countries. And it held together for all of 3 months. In January, the first resignation started taking place. One State Department fellow in the documentary described it as salami tactics. You start with the most liberal elements, and you slice them off, and you slice them off until you have nothing but so-called moderates and right-wingers left. Then you slice off the moderates. Then you just keep moving. You keep moving. And that's what happened in El Salvador. In January, Guillermo Ungo resigned from the junta and took many of his social democrats with him. In March, many of the Christian Democrats resigned from the government because they said that the repression had increased. They were talking about reforms, and those were very pretty words, but at the same time, thousands of people were being killed in their government's name, and they couldn't stomach that anymore. They couldn't take the blame. They left. They were exiled. Mahano, for his own reasons, stayed on. And he thought of resigning in March, but he didn't. He was finally forced to resign a little over a month ago, and he is now under arrest. What you have now in the government of El Salvador has nothing to do with the October Junta, or the so-called reformist military juventud, which asked first to take over power from General Romero in October. These are different animals, totally. And the only single individual left from that first junta is Colonel Abdul Gutierrez, who is working with Duarte, and they are presenting the facade of reforms with repression, as the phrase correctly puts it. At the same time, the right-wing Nazi segment has the run of the land. They can go up, they target an area, they go up, they burn, they kill, they rape, and the government doesn't stop them, the government doesn't protest. The government says, again, that these armed guerrilla communist terrorists are getting their just desserts. And we know that this is not a battle circumstance. This is killing civilians. And so this government is a fraud. And every time you read in the newspaper, the October junta that remains in power is simply false. It's incorrect on a very basic level. What you have right now with the word of the right-wing coup is that the Nazi element and the powerful landowners never intended to allow Duarte to remain in power. Duarte has never been in power, but they don't even want to continue on with the facade. They want to ditch Duarte as soon as they can. They're asking Washington for word of how soon that will be. They ran the flag up the pole to see who would salute. There were some hours, some very significant hours, where Washington was saying, what do we do? Because there's infighting within the Reagan administration as well. The word came out, no. Our little diplomatic tour through Europe didn't work. Our European allies didn't buy the line. And we can't afford to get rid of Duarte yet. We can't afford to reverse this public relations campaign of reforms yet. We can't afford to kill 2,000 people quite yet. Wait, guys. Okay? So Davison backed off. He won't go away. He was arrested before for planning coups, and he walked out of the cuarteles to standing ovations. And this happened in May when I was there. His interests will not go away because they're the people with the true power in the country. So I think that as a policy analyst in wearing that hat, I would say that in the coming weeks and the coming months, we can expect some tensions within the conservative elements, both in Washington and San Salvador, about how fast we can move to the right And I think that a very essential part of their plans is to move against Nicaragua. I think I am hearing gossip out of circles in Washington that they feel that they can overthrow the government in Nicaragua within 18 months. And they're boasting of this. They're boasting of this. I don't want to be too alarmist, but it's an alarming situation. We can expect to see the same kind of destabilizing tactics that took place in Guatemala in 1954 and in Chile in 1972. We can expect severe economic measures because they know that Nicaragua is a poor country, and if people are hungry, they'll be frustrated. We can expect a massive armament of Honduras because Honduras is a little keystone in there. Honduras has borders on Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. Honduras has 5,000 to 10,000, we don't know how many, of Somoza's National Guardsmen just itching to cross that border, and they are crossing that border. They've killed more than 70 Sandinista soldiers and literacy teachers over the past year. So nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about Honduras. Nobody talks about Nicaragua under assault. Nicaragua is undergoing more foreign intervention right now than El Salvador is, other than the U.S. intervention in El Salvador. So if you want to talk about outside forces meddling in internal affairs, don't talk about communists in El Salvador. Talk about Hondurans and Somocistas in Nicaragua.
That was journalist Ann Nelson talking about the situation in El Salvador and the situation of women in El Salvador. And you're listening to A Day of Special Programming on International Women's Day, March 8th, 1981.